Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and this morning's conversation is with Jay Waite. Jay's the Associate Director for Decennial Census in the U.S. Census Bureau in the Department of Commerce. And joining us in our conversation is Tom Berlin.
Jay, the scope of the census has expanded beyond just the enumeration of people for the sole purpose of apportioning seats in Congress identified in the first article of the Constitution. What do you think about this trend?
Well, it's a great trend as far as information. The census becomes a great treasure trove of information about a lot of different subsets of our population. It does complicate the task of doing the census. For example, it's not sufficient anymore that you just count a person once and only once and in the right place. You have to determine what their ethnicity is, what their racial background is, where their parents came from. You have to worry about whether they were housed or in rented units or owned units, or whether they have a house or they don't have a house, what their educational attainment is. And there, it has become a form of identity. A lot of people use the census to establish who they are. And just a couple of examples about that. It's very important to large segments of the Hispanic community that they're able to identify sort of the origin from which they came from. For example, you might be from South America, but people in the Dominican community in New York would like to know how many Dominicans there are. And oftentimes, as in many groups, the young people have long since lost any particular identification with the home country, but their parents want them to be part of that. That complicates the process because it turns out that it's not one census. It's 7 or 8 or 9 censuses because you're trying to do different things. Languages is another big issue. There's clearly parts of the population who do not speak English well enough to do the census, and they need language help. There's also groups in the population who really like the idea that a federal agency would have a questionnaire printed in their language. So that, it gives the census a great mosaic and a great picture. Census provides a great picture of the United States, but it does complicate the process. Counting people is difficult, but counting them and labeling them and identifying them in the various groups that people want to be identified in adds to our challenge on a day-to-day basis.
Jay, no conversation about sort of the census would be complete without talking about sampling. So I'm curious, in 2000, sampling was proposed rather than actual or in addition to actual counting, and I guess there was a belief that the sample would yield a more precise result. But the Supreme Court got involved and struck this down. I'm curious, how should we think about sampling being used to determine the accuracy?
Well, actually, to be clear, there was really two separate issues with sampling. One was the sampling for non-response follow-up. In other words, if I've sent you a form and you didn't answer, rather than go to every door that didn't answer, maybe I could go to a sample of those doors and get enough information for the count. That use of sampling was primarily as a cost savings. I spent a lot of money with people driving to your house and trying to find you home and making 2 or 3 trips there, finally getting you and getting the interview. If I only had to go to a sample of those places, it would save money. That's the part that the Supreme Court struck down, that the Census Act did not allow sampling for purposes of apportionment to decide how many congresspersons went to New Jersey or how many went to Ohio or how many went to Georgia. We were hoping to save money on that. The other piece of sampling, which was much more contentious, is a coverage measurement evaluation. And what that really meant was that for about 300,000 housing units, we went back after the census was conducted. Independent of the census, we went back to those housing units and redid the census and then compared those results with the census results. When they differed, we went back yet again to those houses and adjudicated those differences. From that, we could estimate the proportion of white males between 18 and 29 that were missed or double counted in the census. So the idea was, and has been for 2 or 3 decades now, if you could estimate those proportions at the national level or even at some level smaller than the national level, maybe you could then use those estimates of undercount to adjust the census count. In other words, if you estimated you'd missed more black males between 20 and 39 than you had white males, you might increase black males wherever you'd actually counted them, increase that count to make it sort of compensate for that undercount. That was not prohibited by the Supreme Court. But it was very contentious, and the Census Bureau spent a lot of time and money and effort working on that. In the end, we chose not to do that adjustment because we could not convince ourselves that the adjusted numbers were actually better. You know, there's some error in the survey itself. And the one big problem I talked a little about earlier about duplication, if you're a parent of divorced, a child of a divorced parent, and both parents count you, The theory behind this follow-on survey is that if I come back to your house after the census and I explain real clearly who you should count and who you shouldn't, that if you've made an error in the census, you will see the error of your ways and you will tell me the truth. And that difference then will allow me to find out that there was an undercount or an overcount. What we found all too often is when we went back the second time, they told us exactly the same thing they told us the first time. When the survey and the census agreed, the survey was blind to the fact that there was duplication. So part of our evaluation of that survey, we came to the conclusion that we could not, in fact, convince ourselves that adjusting was going to be better than not adjusting. So that was a long and turbulent process, and a lot of the issues associated with the census were colored by that, as the different political parties were concerned about whether we did that survey or not, or how we did it, and what we used it for. But in the end, we did not use it. We use sampling extensively in statistics, and we use sampling extensively in the Census Bureau. But in the end, something that is so important as to say, I need to count you ideally once and only once and in the right place, and I'm going to use that for the distribution of political powers. Even the smallest amount of sampling error and uncertainty for these small levels just turned out in the end to not be, we were not able to compensate for it. We did not use it for those small areas.
Jay, what do you say to the citizenry, the people who feel the census is just too intrusive? You've talked about the long-form questions, asking everything about your income, your ancestry, all the way down to whether you have an indoor or outdoor bathroom facility, perhaps. How do you answer those folks about it being too intrusive to their life?
I believe that the census clearly asks for a lot of information. We try very hard to make sure that we don't ask for information that is not really useful, number one, for government planning. And number two, we have an absolute fixed prohibition against disclosing any of that information about you to anyone for any reason, for any purpose. It's probably our number one article of faith in the Census Bureau is our confidentiality. Your data will never be shared with anybody, government or private, but we do need that data, what we collect, in order to determine where to put roads, where to put schools. Without that data, and people talk about the famous, do I have indoor bathrooms or outdoor bathrooms, those statistics are the major source of data for the government on the quality of the housing stock. Where in my county or where in my city do I have serious problems with housing? I don't believe the mayor cares whether we have plumbing indoor or outdoor at 401 Elm Street, but if there's a section of the community that has serious problems with housing conditions, has serious problems with transportation, if there's large numbers of people that are commuting to work and there's no bus line over there, those statistics can be used to your advantage as a citizen to be able to help make the case. We don't believe it's overly intrusive. We don't ask everyone those long-form questions, and we're now reducing ourselves down to 250,000 households per month, 3 million households per year out of a population of about 125 to 130 million households. And from that, we believe we can get the information that the government, local governments more than federal, that local governments need for small area decisions and for small area data.
You've talked about the focus on privacy and privacy protection. In today's era of focus on privacy, is there increased pressure on census to protect this data as it relates to things such as immigrants and other definitive data around folks?
I don't know if there's increased pressure. We have always considered that. In fact, we collect data for the census under a law called Title 13 of the U.S. Code, which forbids us by law from sharing that data with anyone for any reason. We've always taken that very, very seriously. People worry in the day of Homeland Security and other things whether there's been attempts at incursion in trying to find out about our data. I can tell you that nobody has asked us for any information. And so I don't see that as a big issue. I believe that most places in the federal government realize that our ability to collect data is so critical that you don't want to compromise that by some sort of short-term advantage. So we've not had any issues. We've not been approached and have not had any challenges at all to our ability to keep your census questionnaire and your census data totally and completely confidential.
Jay, as we established in the first segment, you had a long career as a public servant. I'm curious what advice you'd give to someone interested in a career in public service.
Well, you know, public service is a very interesting and exciting field. It has been very good to me. I would say if you're a young person and you have talents and you have interest and you want to work on something that makes a difference, you should consider the public service as a career, whether it be a career of 2 years, 10 years. Now, I'm kind of an old codger. I've been around for over 30 years. There is a lot of interesting work. It's working with people. It's working on real things. The federal government is, I think, a great place for a young person to find out what they can do. And for some of us, old codgers, we've made it a career out of our whole life.
I'm afraid that'll have to be the last question, Jay. Tom and I want to thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you. You know, the data from the 2000 census is available. You can get on the website, www.census.gov, and click on the American Fact Finder. And that has all the data that was summarized, that was collected from the census about your town, big or small. And you can learn a lot about where you live and the neighborhood in which you are and compare it with the rest of the country. I'd encourage you to look it up. It's there. It's free. Thank you.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Jay Waite, Associate Director for Decennial Census in the U.S. Census Bureau of the Department of Commerce. Be sure and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript to this very interesting conversation. Again, that's businessofgovernment.org. This is Paul Lawrence. Thank you for listening.